This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. This episode, we're talking about breast cancer and overcoming obstacles with Fiona Stevenson. Fiona is one of Breast Cancer Now's voices, a diverse group of people whose lives have been affected by breast cancer and who now help shape the charity's work by sharing their insights and personal experiences. Fiona is a wheelchair user and an active campaigner for disability issues in her local area of Telford and across the UK. She's also the founder of Swimming After Surgery, a local organisation that helps people get back on track with swimming. She first found a lump more than 30 years ago, and she's here to talk to us about the additional obstacles she has faced through breast cancer and how she now uses her voice to help others. Fiona, welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Laura.
Could you start by telling us when and how you were diagnosed with breast cancer?
I found a lump at the age of 22. I went to my GP. He said, wait for two periods to pass. And if it hadn't gone or grown, go back. So I went back. They did a lumpectomy in my local hospital. And I had the lump removed. Didn't think anything more of it. Didn't even think about the word cancer. And then 18 months later, I had another lump in my left breast. Had that removed at a different hospital. Had my third operation at the age of 31, and that didn't go well. And then I had to have the wound cauterized closed 8 months later. And it was after that I noticed the scar didn't look right. And I went back to my GP and they said, oh, because your age, it won't be cancer, but you need to see the breast consultant. Saw the breast consultant, had a needle biopsy. He said he wouldn't need to see me again. I got home to an answer phone message, which was the worst way of being told. The consultant had left an answer phone message on the Thursday, which I received at 6:30 at night when I got home from work. So I hit the answer phone button and the message was not good news. So I rang the hospital the next day, couldn't get hold of him because he was in surgery all day. So I arranged for the hospital appointment the following Tuesday. I turned up and the nursing staff were saying, oh, you need to take your top off. We need to do another biopsy. I said, no, you don't. I just need to speak to the consultant. At this point, a nurse came in wearing a blue and white uniform, but hiding her lanyard. And I didn't know what that significance was. And then 2 weeks after the operation, she appeared wearing her lanyard and the lanyard was green and white, Macmillan. And that was my first experience of this is cancer. And when I asked the consultant what the outcome was, he said, well, we got it all. It's ductal carcinoma in situ, which is early stage breast cancer. But by the way, your previous three operations were also ductal carcinoma in situ. I went, well, why did no one tell me? He said, because you didn't have chemo or radiotherapy. No one thought they had to tell you. So I was 32 at that stage.
So 10 years have passed since you had originally found that lump and you did not know it was cancer all that time?
No.
How did that make you feel when you then heard it was cancer?
I was shocked, but relieved because, as he said, he'd got it all. But it was, why did no one tell me? I was angry and disappointed. But through that, I wanted to change things for those young people that followed my footsteps, because by doing things early you don't necessarily need chemo or radiotherapy, but I think you still need to know what your diagnosis is. So years later I became a Macmillan Cancer Voice, and then I've been involved with Breast Cancer Now as well, campaigning and doing other things since 2006. Things interlink, and it's vital that messages get across, and you can't have one charity not interlinking with another. So that's why I'm involved with an awful lot of stuff, because I think the collaboration saves everybody repeating things over and over and over again and saves reinventing the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you're doing something really important because you've had this experience of feeling like, I guess you had the wool pulled over your eyes, and it's very hard to advocate for yourself. It's very hard to know what treatment to get or how to look after yourself if you don't know what's wrong with you. And we are going to talk a bit about your experience with breast cancer now and with Macmillan in a little bit. But can you tell me what treatment and surgeries did you have after you found out that it was breast cancer?
I had some 6 lumpectomies on the left side, spanning from the age of 22 to 2015. My left mastectomy was done in 2007. And then I had a right mastectomy in 2015. So altogether, I've had 8 breast cancer operations.
Wow. And did you end up having chemotherapy as well?
No, no chemo, no radiotherapy, just the eventually the mastectomies, because I had to fight to get the mastectomy on the left breast because it was my 7th operation. And when it came to my 6th one, I'd said to the consultant, can I have a mastectomy? Because I'm fed up with going through this and you're breast conserving all the time. And he said, well, your first marriage has failed. You're in between men. You've got a better chance of finding a man with 2 breasts than 1. So he breast conserved again, did a lumpectomy. That's February 2006. And then December 2006, it was back again. And at that point, I handed several sheets of A4 type paper over to the nurse and said, can you get the consultant to read this? And I went into the room and he was laughing. And I went, what are you laughing at? And he said, you. He said, you're so tenacious. I turned around and said, well, I know what I want. And he said, I don't like doing mastectomy without reconstruction. And I said, well, I'm the one that's found the lump all the time. If you reconstruct, how am I going to find anything? He said, well, you might not have to find anything. I said, but for my peace of mind, I don't want anything false. I want this removed and that's it. I don't want, in my opinion, cosmetic surgery to be reconstructed because it's not being done at the same time as a mastectomy. And he said, I'm going to agree with your request, but you must go and have counselling for 3 months, which is our protocol, to prove you're of sound mind to make this decision. Because I was under 40. And I was completely and utterly shocked. The psychologist saw me, and on her first visit with me, she went, what are you doing here? I explained. And she went, but this is coming up to be your 7th operation on the same side. I said, yes. I said, what do you think about me? What do you think about my situation? She went, I completely agree with you. You shouldn't be going through this. It should be your word is taken and the consultant listens to you. You shouldn't be having a battle like this. And then in 2015, when it came to having the right one done, even though I'd already had lymphedema in my left torso, I had to go through the same protocol of counselling to have another mastectomy on the other side. And I just couldn't believe what I was going through. But this is why I'm involved with Flat Friends, because people there are talking about their experiences and it's very similar to mine. And they're trying to be forced into having reconstruction, which they don't want. And it's like, well, what do we do? How do we solve this? But by sharing our stories with each other and giving each other peer support, they actually can stand up for their rights and go, no, we're not having reconstruction. This is what we want. This is where we want to be. Please listen to us. But it's still ongoing years and years and years later from what I went through in 2007. Nothing seems to be changing with the consultants because we're always battling to get our views across.
I'm so sorry that you had to go through that difficult experience to get, you know, to not have a reconstruction. It sounds absolutely harrowing on top of everything that you were already going through. In my experience, and, you know, I think broadly, our NHS is absolutely incredible. We have the most amazing healthcare professionals. But there is occasionally you hear of a story of something insensitive that's been said, which then stays with you forever, as in your case. What would you say to healthcare professionals, perhaps who are in the beginning of their career, whether consultants or nurses or junior doctors, in terms of speaking to people who have received a breast cancer diagnosis?
be aware of what they want. Listen to the patient. Don't assume you know it all, because the patient knows their own body and the patient knows what they want. It's a personal choice whether you have reconstruction or choose to go flat. And it's up to you whether you choose to listen to the patient and be aware of their needs. And don't turn around and say, like one health professional did to me when I was recovering from my mastectomy, you're not a proper cancer patient because you haven't had chemo or radiotherapy.
It's unthinkable, really, that these things can be said in a medical setting, and, you know, they must affect you so much. But I'm glad that you're speaking up about it. You mentioned the Flat Friends Facebook group that you're a member of. How yeah. helpful is that community to you?
I found it helpful when I was going through my second mastectomy, because I went, I'm going through all these battles again, and other people were saying, we've had the same issues, this is where we're at, and the peer support is great. But also through that Flat Friends page, we also discovered that if you have separate mastectomies like I had, you still get called for breast screening, which is laughable when there's nothing to mammogram. And it's like, what do we do? How do we cope with this? And it's getting the message across of getting the breast screening service to join up with the GP surgeries or consultants to say, the records are, they've had single mastectomies. Please be aware that they are not eligible for breast screening.
So is there another way that you can be looking out for ongoing problems when you haven't had reconstruction?
Yeah, there's all different ways of doing things, and I can't imagine what it'd be like to have a mammogram when you've had reconstruction, because of that would be really, really painful in my opinion. But everybody's different, everybody has their own choices, but I'm lucky with the choices I've made. I'm really happy with the choices I've made, and I'm glad I stuck to them, because I'm much happier than I was when I was lopsided. I called myself lopsided Lush in 2007, and I call myself your flatmate. That's my way of coping with what's happened to me. And because I've got a smile on my face, people don't notice what's missing.
Mm.
I've had people really understand my situation, and they've been so helpful, and they go, it's okay. When a member of my staff says, but she's not gone for a mammogram, and another member of staff will go, she doesn't need to, because they've got my situation, they've understood it. But if somebody's new and not used to the terminology, they don't understand what's going on.
Would you be comfortable telling us about your disability and how long you've been in a wheelchair?
Yeah, my disability was diagnosed in 2010. It started in 2006, aggravating me. I was walking up a hill in Shrewsbury and I couldn't walk up the hill. So I turned around and walked up the hill backwards, got to the office, and my boss said to me, you don't look great. I said, I don't feel great. He said, what's the matter? I said, my back hurts. And he said, don't come back into work until you've seen a GP. So I went and saw the GP, who thought I'd pulled a muscle in my back, and said, if you know better in 3 weeks, come back. I went back and they started doing tests. And then I had the breast cancer again in 2007. So the test got postponed. And then I got the full diagnosis in 2010, which was a 6-page letter, which is an extra vertebra in my lower spine from birth, hip dysplasia from birth, osteoarthritis, spondylitis, and fibromyalgia. All in one letter. Nothing was told to me verbally. I just had to deal with all of that in that letter. And it was like, what? How do I cope with this? But when I got told in person that I would need a wheelchair, I went, that's okay. And they went, how come you're so blasé about it? And I said, I had an MRI scan in 2010. And I said, you told me at that point I got a shadow on my spine and you left me for 3 weeks waiting for the results. And I said, when you told me that I needed a wheelchair, it was like, that's okay. And they went, why? And I said, the word shadow on my spine in my head meant that I thought I got bone cancer and therefore thought I was only had 18 months to live. So I'd been writing a bucket list. And at that point, they went, light bulb moment. And they went, why did you think that? I said, because I've had breast cancer. I thought it had gone into my bones. And they went, okay. And then within 6 months of that conversation, I got invited back to the hospital where there was a Macmillan meeting and they were talking about setting up a soft tissue tumour unit at the hospital for sarcoma patients. So out of a negative experience, again, positives have come. And so don't be afraid to voice your opinions on what's gone right or what's gone wrong for you or what you imagined to be happening to you, because you never know what outcome can come from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it also just highlights the importance of healthcare professionals being open and honest with us, because when you've had cancer, quite rightly, you do jump to those conclusions. You know, I have secondary breast cancer and any ache, pain or whatever that I have, I always think, oh, it must be related to breast cancer spreading. And it's natural that you had that opinion about that it could be breast cancer in your spine. I'm glad it wasn't, but it doesn't sound, you know, you obviously had this horrible letter with all these different diagnoses. And have you experienced any extra obstacles that being disabled has added to your experience of breast cancer?
Yeah. X-ray departments. The cubicles cannot accommodate a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So because I am an expert patient, I know that if I haven't got a bra on and I've got a t-shirt with no metal in it and I've got trousers with no metal in it, I can be scanned without having to change into one of those stupid gowns or shawls that my local hospitals have now got, because I can't get into the changing room. I don't want to be a nuisance. I don't want to increase their laundry bill. So I just take stuff that I can easily wash at home, put a t-shirt on and a pair of tracksters, because there's no metal in them. It's easy to do and I haven't got to worry about, oh, I've got metal in me, or I've got pieces of jewellery around me. I only go with what I need to have. So I go with my spectacles, no watch, just t-shirt and tracksters. And then it's easy to be in the department like that. And it's far easier for them because I can just get wheeled into the x-ray department for my scan. And it's so much easier, but it's understanding and knowing what is acceptable and what isn't.
Yeah, I know that having spoken to a friend of mine, an author, Chloe Timms, who I'm sure wouldn't mind me mentioning her, she's got a brilliant book called The Sea Women, which is actually about swimming. She's in a wheelchair and she talked to me about the stuff that as a person not in a wheelchair, I would never have known about, like access to restaurants and just being able to go to the toilet in the restaurant, which is, you know, often just not possible in a wheelchair. What are the areas of your life where you feel there need to be improvements for wheelchair users, whether in the hospital setting or elsewhere?
I'm involved with railway companies. So I'm involved with a couple at the moment. I'm involved with West Midlands Trains and Cross Country to improve access there. If you're on a train and the toilet doesn't work, especially for a wheelchair user, that is a no-no. So we have to be catered for and not just assume that it's all okay. It's not okay. We all need to be catered for. We all need the space. We all need to be able to do what we need to do. No passengers should be sat on the floor. No passengers should be overcrowded. And when I'm in my wheelchair and I get put on a train and luggage is in the wheelchair space, even though it says wheelchair priority, more people put their luggage in it because there's no space for luggage in the carriages. But the trouble is, when we get put on the train like that, the guards have to shout for the luggage to be moved so we can get where we need to be on the train. And the passengers were like, well, she can go on another carriage, can't she? Or she can go on another train. No, I'm entitled to go where I've paid to go.
Of course, yeah.
I shouldn't be told I can't go where I need to go because luggage is in the way. Taxis are another bone of contention, private hire. They'll pick my wheelchair up by one handle, drop it on the floor and go, oops, we broke it. Or they'll do what one person did, which was they'd loaded my wheelchair in the car and then decided they didn't want to take me. So they unloaded it and said, we prefer to take a drunk than you.
Wow.
I've also been to Birmingham where a black cab turned around and said, can't you leave the wheelchair behind and just get in? I've also had another one when we pre-booked the taxi saying, I wasn't told about the effing wheelchair. I want to charge extra for it. That's illegal. But these are the battles I have daily. So it's hard when you want to go out and it's really difficult. And then there's no regulation until 2030. It's driver discretion on buses if they take a wheelchair.
Wow. I'm so sorry that, you know, that all of these things in 2024 are still so difficult for someone in a wheelchair. It really is shocking.
Initially, I was given an attendant wheelchair because in 1999, when I had my fourth operation, because it affected some of the lymph nodes, I had limited movement on my left arm. So that's most of the movement I had. I couldn't raise it above my head. And then in 2009... I was given the chance to go to Rotary Disabled Championships in Coventry, where I was given the chance to bench press. And that night in the hotel, when I was having a shower, having bench pressed, I felt my shoulder was a bit different in the shower. And I decided to push my arm a bit further than I normally could. And before you know it, it was above my arm, above my head. And it was like, wow, that exercise, that movement has just freed my arm up. Oh. So I went to Rotary and told them what had happened. And the next morning they went, you were trying to tell us, but the disco music was on. We couldn't understand what you're talking about. Are you hurt? I went, no, it's the opposite. The issue was I'd got limited movement in my left arm, but by being given an opportunity to try bench pressing, I've got the use of my arm back. And they went, wow, really? I went, yeah, that's exactly what's happened. So when I got back from those championships, my attendant wheelchair got traded in at Wheelchair Services for a self-propelling one. So I'm now a lot more independent than I was then.
Oh, well, that's brilliant. And I think that that brings us nicely into swimming after surgery, which is something that you set up. Can you tell us about that and how it works?
We set up Swimming After Surgery, brackets SAS, in Telford to help a friend who'd had a mastectomy. And she'd had a mastectomy in 2008. We were talking in April of how I could help her. And she said, I want to be able to learn to swim, but I can't afford the lessons. That was a Sunday night in April. I'm not one that sits and just thinks. I actually do. So at 8:30 on the Monday morning, I rang the swimming coordinator at the local authority and says, I want to set up MSG, mastectomy swimming group, for ladies with cancer. That's a good idea, but go to the breast cancer support group and get feedback. Oh boy, did I get feedback. 4 sheets of A4 paper. You've been too narrow-minded. Lumpectomies leave you to guards too. I thought, okay, back to the drawing board. What am I going to call this now? So SAS came to mind and I had to work out how am I going to form words to fit SAS, because I wanted to empower ladies and feel make them feel better about themselves. So Swimming After Surgery came to mind, and I say in brackets SAS, so we have a laugh with it, because I'm not part, not one that's going to be called in to solve military problems, but it's just a way of having a giggle. So we set it up. So the council initially found funding for it for 6 months through their contacts. And then after that, I formed a committee, went to Macmillan, got a grant for it to continue it. So I got a grant for $3,000 from Macmillan. And then after that, it was, how can we sustain this? So we do fundraising activities like making poppies or fundraising challenges of other sorts. And then because I'm involved with other groups, I learned how to crochet butterflies. So we make pink and yellow butterflies because the yellow is to remind us of somebody that's passed, and the pink is to remind us of life to the full. And that's the colour of our poppies as well. So they're bright pink and bright yellow to help keep funds going. But while we're not running at the moment, what we're doing for people in treatment is we're making crochet shawls free of charge. Everything's donated. We just send them out in the post and they can put them on their shoulders. And when they're cold, take them off when they're hot. And it's easy because they haven't got to worry about a cardigan or a jumper. They've just got something they can have over their legs or over their shoulders when they're cold, and they get to keep them and do what they want.
And is there a way that our listeners can find out more about this?
Yeah, I've got my Facebook page, Swimming After Surgery, and they can contact me there. And if others want to get involved and make them, then that's fine with me. So yeah, happy to do what we can.
Brilliant. Well, we'll share those links in the show notes. Thank you.
I'm Gareth, the editor of Vita magazine. Vita is Breast Cancer Now's magazine for anyone affected by breast cancer. It's full of inspiring real-life stories, expert tips on coping with the effects of breast cancer, and articles on health and well-being. In our new spring issue, you can read about a mother and daughter who were both diagnosed with breast cancer 12 years apart, find out the latest in breast cancer research, get tips on coping with fatigue, read about the benefits of getting outdoors, and much more. Subscribe to Vita now at breastcancernow.org/Vita.
I'm a big swimmer myself. I had a massive surgery last year to remove my sternum bone. And for me, getting back to swimming after surgery was such a huge thing to go through, but it was so helpful and just really helped my mind as well as my body. What does swimming mean to you in terms of your mental health and your physical health too?
Swimming means an awful lot to me because a lot of people assume because I'm in my wheelchair that I can't swim. But I actually swim without using my legs. So it helps keep my arm movement, reduces lymphedema. It helps me be more active. And when I have been swimming, I sleep so much better.
Yeah, I recognise that.
So swimming is a great activity.
Yeah, absolutely. I just, before we move on to talk about your work as a breast cancer voice and a Macmillan voice, I just want to ask you about dignity, because dignity is something that you've spoken about in your work. And it's a huge and important topic when we talk about hospital treatment, when we talk about cancer, when we talk about palliative care and even death. What does the word dignity mean to you and how can we achieve it?
Dignity for me as a young cancer patient, I'm going back to the days of when I had my first treatment. Dignity is being respected as a young adult and being told what I needed to know and not assume that I don't need to know it. Dignity is respecting people's wishes. So when somebody says they want a mastectomy, they should be listened to. And their reasoning should be listened to as to why they want a mastectomy without reconstruction or whatever it is. There might well be a reason behind it. It could be family history. It could be worry. It could be, we've had enough of this, please help. It could be whatever. But just listen to patients and what they want. Dignity means to me that everyone, regardless of age, creed, whatever, should be listened to and not judged. And consultants, doctors don't know it all. Please listen to the patient. If the patient is worried, please listen to them and check, because doctors don't want to get sued for getting it wrong. A patient might know their own body better than the consultant.
That, if I may give a personal recommendation, that reminds me of Dr. Catherine Mannix, the palliative care doctor's book called Listen, which is all about the power of just listening to get through so many different things. And she talks about dignity there as well. So maybe we'll put that link in the show notes as well. So moving on, you are a breast cancer voice, which is part of Breast Cancer Now's initiative to get direct feedback from patients to shape the charity's work. Why did you feel it was important to offer your voice and your experiences?
Well, I've been part of email campaigns for ages, and anything Breast Cancer Now was sharing, I was emailing my MP, dealing with campaigns online, and I decided, well, I've got a voice, I use it with Macmillan, why not use it with Breast Cancer Now? And the other thing that I did in 2022, I did their 10-mile swim in July, and I was moving house at the time, and I'd managed to do 5 miles during 5 different days. So I'd done a mile a day, and I knew on the weekend I was moving all my stuff at the weekend, and knew I wasn't going to be having time to fit the swimming in with the move. So on the Friday, time was getting short, and I thought, I'm going to struggle to get this all fitted in. So I went to the pool where I swim in, and I started off. I did 86 lengths, then 86 lengths, then 86 lengths, then 86 lengths, and another 86 lengths. So I'd done 5 miles in one go.
Wow.
I got at the pool quite proud of myself and was a little bit shaky. Got in my wheelchair and flopped, got changed. And one of the staff said to me, "You okay?" I said, "I will be." I said, "Just got to catch my breath." And she went, "What have you done?" I said, "I've just completed my 10-mile swim." And she went, "You've done 5 miles the other day, haven't you?" I went, "Yeah." She said, "Does that mean you've done all 5 today?" I went, "Yeah." She went, "I'll go and get you a drink."
at that point, you need
And then I got picked
sugar.
Up. And the person who picked me up says, "I don't know when to say well done or stupid."
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was one of them, but it was... I was adamant I was going to do it, and I raised over £300 for Breast Cancer Now, so I was glad I did it. And yeah, it really pushed me to get out there and keep myself fit. So yeah, Breast Cancer Now raise awareness of issues like we've been talking about today, but they also need to know that there are things that need to change. My biggest thing that I want to change is health and life insurance. Because when I was 22, no one expects to get cancer, and you're working and you're just starting out. So you want to enjoy life. You wouldn't think of getting insurance in place, or I certainly didn't. I wish I had, because the impact now is I'm in social care for the rest of my life because I can't get a mortgage because I can't get life insurance.
Yeah.
And that's tough. So if I was talking to my younger self at 20, it'll be as soon as you start work, get insurance, income insurance, income protection, all the other stuff, get it, because you never know when you come to apply for a mortgage what you're going to need. But definitely get insurance in place. It might not seem important right now, but believe me, with what I've gone through, I wish I'd had it, because I'm in social care now for the rest of my life. I can't get a mortgage. And when you start out and you want to work, you're aiming to get your own home. It's so difficult. And I wish I had that cushion, but I haven't. I've got no private pension, so I'm going to be relying on the state pension. I'm reliant on the state for housing, and it's not the way I want to be. I don't want to be a burden to society. I want to do stuff and help others. And I'm hoping that my story will encourage the industries to really look at, she checked herself, she was doing everything right, why is she penalised?
Yeah.
And I really want that message to come across, because that's how I feel.
And have you been able to access financial support?
I've got benefits like Employment Support Allowance and PIP, and that's it, and I get housing benefit, but it's not what I wanted. It's not the way I wanted this. And Macmillan do grants to help people who've changed shape, gained weight, lost weight, whatever. And they also do other grants to help teenagers get a laptop when they want to stay in touch with their friends. But it's It's tough.
Yeah. I understand that you've also had a really humiliating experience in when you were trying to claim the PIP benefit. Is that right?
No, that was when I was on incapacity benefit. I got told to go to the job centre the day before my mastectomy in 2007. And I said to the DWP at the time, I said, I've got a mastectomy on Wednesday, but you want me to attend the job centre? And they went, if you don't, your benefits will be stopped immediately. So I turned up at the job centre the day before with my hospital consent letter, passed it tentatively over the counter to the lady who was seeing me, tried to keep my composure, which is not easy when you're fretting about a forthcoming major operation. And she saw the state I was in and went, is somebody with you? I said, yes. So she got the person with me to come over and I had a drink of water and she said, take her home. She's genuine. We won't be pestering her. And then in November 2007, months after I'd had the mastectomy, I got called into medical services as to why I was on incapacity benefit. And I turned up. I'd got bronchitis. My GP had told me to not go. And they said, if you don't turn up, your benefits are going to be stopped immediately. This is their favourite phrase. So turned up and this assessor said, I want you to bend down and touch your toes. And at that point, I couldn't do it. And we didn't know what the problem was. And I just said, I've got a lump on my spine, which doesn't allow me to do that. And she said, where's your lump? And I wish I'd never told her because I told her where it was. She didn't just press on it once. She didn't just press on it twice. She pressed on it three times and each time made me scream horrendously. And then she said, you're not cooperating with what I'm getting you to do. I need you to show me your mastectomy scar to prove you've had one. And I went, what? And she said, if you don't, your benefit's going to be stopped immediately. And I was part of a Macmillan campaign online in 2021 with the DWP asking why they do this. And the patients who were also there were saying, this happened to me, this happened to me, this happened to me. And some of them are recently as 3 weeks prior to that meeting. And it was like, I thought all this had stopped. I campaigned on this in 2007 to get this stopped. I wrote to the DWP. I wrote to my MP. Why is this not stopping? This is barbaric. And the DWP are wasting so much money on these assessors when all they've got to do is look at the hospital records of that patient. But they're not doing that. They're still getting these assessors to come out. And even when I switched over from disability living allowance to PIP, they sent a home assessor out to me, a lone male to a lone vulnerable female, goodness sake. Luckily, I had a carer who was able to open the door to them and said, if I wasn't here, she wouldn't be seeing you. And the assessor said, what do you mean? Well, a lone female, use common sense, safeguarding. But it was like, what do I do? So he came in, I was lying in bed because it was a really bad day. I couldn't get out of bed. And he said, what's your conditions? I started listening to him. He said, but I've only got an hour. I said, here's all my medical records. I passed them to him. He went, I haven't got time to read all that lot. I said, well, that lot proves that I've got all this. And he went, we have to talk to you and listen to you. That's it. He said, we do not take any records away. We don't notice anything. I just don't get it. I don't understand why health professionals' letters aren't accepted. It would save an awful lot of money with a DWP. It would just mean it was so much easier for genuine claimants.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can't imagine how all that made you feel as well. You know, you're obviously still incredibly frustrated by it.
I am, but as I say, it's just a matter of common sense. If somebody's got the medical record folders with every letter that they've ever had, every diagnosis they've ever had, that should be accepted, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that should just be taken electronically, or when you obviously get asked to supply it, they surely don't need to come around to your house to do that when they've got the documents.
But they do.
Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful that you are using all these negative experiences and turning them into positive experiences and talking and sharing your voice and your experiences so that you can help others. And that's what you're doing with this podcast today, which is fantastic. Well as working with Breast Cancer Now, you're also involved with Macmillan on a domestic abuse initiative. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, because I have had cancer, I've also been the victim of domestic abuse. And it's subtle. The way they can pick it up now is if you're late for appointments on a regular basis and you go in for x-ray or go into a scan, the radiographers are now trained to ask, is everything all right? We've noticed you've been late for a few appointments, or you seem a bit stressed. What's wrong? And because you're in radiography on your own, because that's a natural segregation, it's a great way of being able to open up and say exactly how you're feeling.
Yeah.
And some people might say, I'm okay. But after three or four sessions, like going for scans or whatever, they actually feel, we can get on with this person who's scanning us or seeing us. And they might open up and go, actually, everything's not all right. I'm worried that I haven't got enough money in my bank account, and yet I know I had money in there. Or the person who's bringing me to hospital is always making me late. It's like they don't want to bother. Or it could be, actually, I'm being beaten black and blue and I really need help. But on average, it takes 27 attempts to leave a domestic abuse situation. So you cannot judge, you cannot say to somebody, we'll get the police, we'll get you into a refuge. That might not work for everybody. Just let them do it in their own time and in their own space. I was unique in that I booted the perpetrator out. In retaliation, they took my mobility car, they took all my mobility aids, they'd gone around the back of the house, removed my wheelchair, got my blue badge, and basically were trying to jail me. I reported my mobility car stolen, got permission from the police to get it back. And on the Sunday morning after I got it back, I got a message to ring 101. And while I was on the phone, a police car with blue lights turned up. Two police officers got out, were running up my path. And just at that point, we'd established the mobility car was mine. They ran down away from the door and got back in the car and drove off. They were there to arrest me for stealing my own car back.
Oh, gosh, I'm so sorry for this entire horrific experience that you've been through. And again, all I can say is thank you for turning it around and finding ways to talk about it and help others, because that initiative of healthcare professionals being there to subtly check and ask and get you on your own to ask you whether you're okay, whether everything's okay at home. I've actually seen those posters in my own hospital in the ladies' toilets saying if you're experiencing any kind of domestic abuse or coercive control.
But the other thing is, domestic abuse doesn't just happen to females, it happens to males too.
Absolutely.
So we're also educating the professionals to listen to them as well.
Yeah.
Because it can be the patient is abusing the carer or vice versa. Mm. And these things really have to be considered. It's not a one-way street.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're here on the Breast Cancer Now podcast and we've covered so many different topics today, and there's no way we can cover them all in the depth that they deserve. But I think just one thing from my perspective is that, you know, when you are in the healthcare setting, you've got a breast cancer diagnosis, you do have access to medical professionals. And whilst they may not be the experts in mental health or in domestic abuse issues, if there is someone in the hospital who you trust and who you feel you can confide in, then you can talk to someone and say, you know, I'm having these issues at home. And hopefully, in most cases, they'll be able to point you in the right direction and give you the support that you need in some way. So thank you for telling us about the work that you've been doing with Macmillan. If people would like more resources to help with disabilities in breast cancer care, is there anything that you could recommend?
just look around and see what's available. And if there isn't something that they really need, let breast cancer know, because they can contact people like myself, got experience of it, and we could go, well, this might be useful, that might be useful. But it's also when the hospitals are building new sites, be aware that X-ray departments aren't set up for people in wheelchairs, even though that's where people go with broken legs. They end up in the corridor because they're waiting outside in the corridor in the wheelchairs because there isn't room in the waiting room for them. And it's hilarious. It shouldn't be like that, but that's the reality of it.
There is a question that we ask everyone on this podcast, and that is, if you could change one thing in terms of breast cancer diagnosis, treatment and beyond in the coming years, what would it be?
Listen to the patients, and for those that want mastectomies, that do not want reconstruction, please, please, please listen to them and listen to their reasons as to why. Do not force us to go through the 3 months counselling to prove we're a sound mind to make that decision. That's degrading. We don't want mental abuse like that. We need to be supported. And that is just my one wish.
Fiona, thank you so much. You've shared so many of your very personal stories here. And I think the message that we've got from this is that, you know, you're sharing your stories in order to help others and on so many different areas. And I'm so, so grateful for you. And I'm sure there's a lot of people that will feel supported and feel helped and feel seen by some of the things you've said today. So thank you so much for joining us on the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you. I hope it is useful. And if you're not sure of something, please speak up. Please ask for whatever you want. Because if you don't ask the question, you never know what that could lead to.
Thank you, Fiona. If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.